I was strolling on the moon one day in a merry month of December.
No, May.
May.
May is the month.
May, that's right.
May is the year of the month.
When, much to my surprise, a pair of bunny eyes. Do-do-do-do-do.
And good evening, everyone. My name is Larry Heron, and this is Talking Space, episode 1603. And today is Saturday, March 2nd, 2024. And boy, do we have a lot to talk about tonight, huh, boys? Starting with that little piece of audio. This is my little quiz, I guess, for the night for both our listeners and our participants here. Got any idea where that is from?
Yes, the dulcet tones from Taurus Littro of Gene Cernan and Harrison Jack Schmidt on the lunar surface cavorting around. And if I recall exactly, that was the last time the United States, at least, had a presence on the lunar surface. That all changed this week.
I should have known that Gene would come up with it out of everybody who's here. So speaking of which, joining me tonight, we have Gene Mikulka. Good evening, Gene.
Good evening, Larry. It has been like drinking from several fire hoses this week.
I'm
looking forward to getting into the meat of the matter with the crew here.
Me too. Also joining us is Mark Ratterman. Hi there, Mark.
I am not that good on my history, but I can certainly appreciate that it is there.
There you go. So I also wanted to mention that Dr. Kat Robison and Sawyer Rosenstein are out tonight, but they will be back. And tonight, I guess we'll get right into it with the news roundup. First off, Gene, I hear that Blue Origin's got some exciting things going on right now. What can you tell us about that?
Larry, they have moved their New Glenn Pathfinder vehicle out to Launch Complex 36. This really, really is a big-time milestone. It's the first time that that vehicle, has hit the launch pad, and this is really to go ahead and test the vehicle to see if it is totally and completely compatible with all of the launch pad hookups and all of the umbilicals that are out there. They'll do some cryo loading testing in a few weeks, but this is a huge milestone for Blue Origin on their way to space. So good luck to them.
Well, this ought to be interesting. It's interesting to see something else besides a SpaceX manufactured ship on the launch pad. So next, news about Crew 8, which is launching later this evening.
Crew 8's launch opportunity will be tonight at 11:16 p.m. Eastern Standard Time or 4:16 a.m. UTC on March 3rd. However, weather in and around the Cape isn't looking too favorable, and it's not just the weather at Cape Canaveral, it's the weather also at the various launch abort sites, so that's something else they have to go ahead and take into account. NASA's Matthew Dominick, Mike Barrett, and this will be his third trip to the ISS, and Jeanette Epps round out the NASA contingent, and Roscosmos's Alexander Grebkin. We'll all be part of this particular ISS increment. This will be Expedition 70/71, where they'll conduct about 200 investigations. NASA astronaut Tracy Dyson will join the crew a little later, arriving on a Soyuz vehicle, replacing Laura O'Hara. Crew 8 will return to Earth sometime this fall, and this will be SpaceX's ninth flight with its most precious cargo of all, human beings. And Mark, you've got something to add to all of that fun litany and all those stats.
Sure do. 5 years after launching the first crew-capable Dragon spacecraft on their first demonstration mission, Crew 8 marks their 13th human spaceflight. They'll be carrying their 50th crew member to orbit, and to date, they have flown crew from 14 different countries around the world. The spacecraft previously flew the first human spaceflight mission as Demo 2, as well as Crew 2, AX-1, and Crew 6 missions. This will be the first Dragon spacecraft to support their fifth human spaceflight mission. Go SpaceX, go Crew 8. Certainly, we're with you.
Amen to that. To move on, Gene, you have some news about some changes in management in the ISS program?
Indeed there, Larry. Dana Weigel was going to go ahead and replace Joel Montalbano as the International Space Station Program Manager effective April 7th. And I'll read directly from the NASA press release on this. NASA has selected Dana Weigel as the International Space Station Program Manager based at the agency's Johnson Space Center in Houston. Weigel succeeds Joel Montalbano, who has accepted a position as the Deputy Associate Administrator for the agency's Space Operations Mission Directorate at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. Both positions will be in effect on April 7. So people moving on up, which is good to see.
Very good. Next up, some new developments, I guess, and also related to the International Space Station, but this time some issues, some problems.
Yeah, well, to go back to Crew 8 just for a second, we're talking about the ISS here too, and Joel Montalbano last week at the Flight Readiness Review Conference was talking about scheduling. He had a question with reference to scheduling and why this particular mission had been pushed back a couple of times. And Montalbano likened it to the most sophisticated game of Tetris that you can possibly come up with. The ISS office basically has seven missions to manage this year. He was asked why the initial delay with Crew 8. And mostly it was due to the launch window of the Intuitive Machines mission, which had priority because of its lunar launch window. The ISS office had to adjust their particular project and to keep as many launch opportunities as they had open. But once IM-1 was underway, the Crew 8 window flew wide open. We were talking a little bit more about Crew Dragon, too, and Mark, you kind of alluded to this, the Crew Dragon Endeavor. This is its fifth mission, and if you remember, that was kind of what they thought the launch limit of these things were, five missions apiece, and they would have to decommission these particular capsules. Well, according to Bill Gerstenmaier at SpaceX, then that still seems weird to me even years later. He basically said, not so fast. He thinks that they could possibly extend the life of these modules or the Crew Dragons to maybe 10 missions, 15 missions on the outside. He says there are going to be components that will need replacement before others. But all in all, he believes that the 10 mission window is indeed possible. They were looking at some valves also. Steve Stitch from NASA also indicated that some valves on board Crew Dragon Endeavor had to be replaced due to some corrosion. There was some sort of nonconformance on a composite-based system on the spacecraft. They really didn't get into a lot of the specifics on that. But SpaceX and NASA are looking into that particular issue. Also, Gerst said it was good to have the cargo missions because he looked at the cargo missions as sort of a test bed, if you will, to buy down risk on the crew missions. And also, he says he's also alluded to that the Axiom missions, specifically the last one that just took place, Axiom 3, also assisted in buying down a lot of risk for Crew 8. They had a lot more time on orbit, free flying, between undocking from the ISS and splashdown than NASA's missions usually have. And as such, they kind of stressed the ECLS systems on board Crew Dragon a little bit more, so they learned a little bit more from that mission. Again, gaining more insight and gaining more ideas in what kind of vehicle they've got. So, again, Gerst looks at these cargo missions as a way to buy down risk. And again, we were talking offline a little bit about CRS-30, when that mission will be. Well, they're going to fly that mission off of the newly refitted Launch Complex 40. That will be the first SpaceX cargo mission to launch from there since refitting the launch pad to service crew. Now, the idea with this is they're going to go ahead and do a dress rehearsal on all of the procedures you're going to need to launch crew from that launch pad with that mission. So it's going to be kind of intriguing to watch and see how the performance goes on that. They'll be testing everything you need to do to go ahead, almost everything you need to do to go ahead and launch crew from there. So, and it was, again, Gerst was saying this will give us a comfort level when we go ahead and finally launch crew from that vehicle, that launch pad, I'm sorry. They figure that's probably going to be Crew 9, the next increment coming up. So we'll see how all this goes with CRS-30 on this. There was some Starliner news that came out of that. The processing for Starliner is moving along. All of the OFT2 issues have been closed out. There was a valve issue on the active thermocontrol system, which that's also being closed out, that issue. The vehicle is currently in the processing facility at KSC. It's one of the old orbiter processing facilities. The next step for Starliner is a propellant load for the spacecraft that is going to be happening presently, and they are targeting no earlier than an April 22 launch attempt for that vehicle on top of a modified ULA Atlas V. So things are looking real good. As far as the chutes are concerned, we talked a little bit about this on this show earlier. They are well on their way to final certification. The test was performed in January. Really looked good, according to Steve Stitch. The hardware, he said, looked fantastic. Also, Dream Chaser. They are targeting the second quarter of this year for the Sierra Nevada Dream Chaser cargo craft to the International Space Station. This will also be the second flight for the United Launch Alliance Vulcan Centaur booster. And if all goes well with that launch, Vulcan Centaur will be fully certified for DOD and national security missions. So it's going to be a one to launch. And yeah, believe it or not, JAXA had something to say at the FRR. JAXA's new HTVX, their new cargo craft. It's about some 26 feet tall and some 14 feet in diameter. It is moving along and expected to launch sometime in 2025. So there was a lot to be learned from that FRR.
So next we're looking at another issue with the International Space Station.
Yeah, unfortunately, during the pre-flight Crew 8 conference back on February 28th, the ISS program manager Joel Montalbano indicated that the atmosphere leak that's been plaguing a vestibule in the docking port of Russia's Vesta module to the tune of about a pound a day, that leak has increased to a little over 2 pounds a day. The leak was first noticed in 2019, and both NASA and Roscosmos have indicated that there is absolutely no impact to the crew or to the normal operations of the International Space Station. The increase in the atmosphere loss in the module was noticed about a week before the scheduled arrival of the Russian 87 Progress module. When Progress arrived, the plan was to keep the hatches closed for 24 hours to, as Joel Montalbano put it, let things dampen out a bit and see if the hatch closures would impact the leak. And unfortunately, no change was noticed. Now, NASA and Roscosmos indicate that the crew nor the facility itself is in no danger, and the vestibule could be simply sealed off if need be, posing no further threat to the safe operation of the station. However, like all things, including myself, the ISS is getting old, and things like this will just simply increase. At the NASA Aerospace Safety Advisory Panel session this week, General Susan Helms, who's the new chairperson, replacing the retiring Patricia Saunders, indicated that the plan to bring down the International Space Station at the end of its operational lifetime represents, quote, one of the most urgent safety issues in the near term right now. And it's something that the safety advisory panel finds as a critical concern. It also should be noted that commercial crew nor the ISS office gave presentations at that particular meeting during that session. Now, we'll be watching this closely to see what develops. But again, it's just one of those, we all get older, we all get these aches and pains, and the ISS is unfortunately showing its age.
Yep. It happens to the best of us, even the ISS.
Indeed.
So, moving from the ISS to the Artemis program, there's some news about Artemis as well.
Yes, sir, there are. This is also coming from the Aerospace Safety Advisory Panel. They met this week not only to discuss the ISS and its situation, but also Artemis and seeing how that lunar program is moving along. And again, General Susan Helms indicated that she had a nice long discussion with NASA's Associate Administrator for Space Exploration Systems, Kathy Korner, and was very pleased with the efforts that NASA is making with Artemis. Paul Hill, who is the former director of NASA's Mission Operations for Human Spaceflight, he echoed the same thoughts, basically saying that this was a very, very complex mission campaign, but he believed that NASA currently is setting themselves up for success. But the real meat of the matter was when William Bray addressed the panel. He has served in various naval and defense research programs. He gave his observations, and for the most part, they were quite favorable. He indicated that the postponement of Artemis II, adjusting the launch date to September of 2025, was probably the right call, to give time to catch up with a lot of things. And he also said the two issues that the safety advisory panel is watching for Artemis II are the heat shield char loss and something that I didn't hear about until that point in time, the Orion hatch door. The heat shield seems to be getting very, very close to a solution in understanding what's going on there. There's been significant lab testing, and something that kind of impressed Bray a little bit was that they were using a lot of computer modeling to provide a foundation to any of the findings that they come up with. The focus basically is on the density of the shield itself and on the Avcoat coating. He added, quote, "We encourage the team to be transparent, inclusive, and look at any constructive challenges to their data, so this issue can be brought to closure," saying also that we are in a very good place here. Now, on the hatch, Bray indicated that the crew reported some issues opening the hatch quickly in the event of a contingency issue. The astronaut office is also involved in looking at this issue, and their insight is going to be invaluable to anything that they come up with any design changes or any operational concept changes. He added that a lot of good work is going on here, and he's looking forward to looking at their deep dive into the issue once it's prepared. In his estimation, Artemis II is moving along, and he does not see any showstoppers as far as Artemis II is concerned.
Were those two issues with the char and the hatch, were those something that were found as a result of the Artemis I mission, or is that?
The heat shield, yes. That has been basically a thorn in NASA's side for a while. They discovered the additional char in the heat shield where none should be, and it kind of left a lot of people scratching their heads a little bit. And they were like, huh, all right, what's going on here? Let's take a step back and see what's happening. It was something they just didn't expect to see. And when you're dealing with spaceflight, you don't like to see things you don't expect. So it's one of the reasons why, too, Artemis II got pushed back to September of 2025. Excuse me. They wanted to make sure that issue had been closed out, because, you know, things, unexpected things with a heat shield, you don't like seeing. I had not heard about the door, I'll be honest with you, until listening to the safety advisory panel session that went on this week. It was kind of shades of Apollo 1 a little bit.
Ooh.
You know, that's the way I immediately thought of, because, you know, I'm a layman, I'm not an engineer, but it's something too that the astronaut office has on their radar. They're working really hard to try to find out, is it an operational thing they have to thing? Is it a procedural thing they have to fix? Or is it indeed a design thing they have to go back and maybe, you know, play around with the design of the latch on the door? So, again, they're doing their deep dive. They'll get to the root of the matter and we'll have a better spacecraft.
Kind of reminds me of Buzz Aldrin and his tale about Apollo 11 when he was trying to get the hatch of the lunar module open, having a hard time with it.
He stepped out, and as he was stepping out, he said, okay, I'm going to step outside and partially close the hatch. And he said, making sure not to lock it on my way out. And Armstrong got a really good chuckle out of that. And he responded, hey, that's our home for the next couple hours. We'll take good care of it. So, you know, his mind was right.
He was
right
also worried about
bending
the hatch so that it wouldn't seal right when they went to close it up again.
That's true. That's absolutely correct. So, yeah, the hatch is kind of an important deal. So you want to make sure that, that's going to seal and provide an airtight seal, and you can pop it open really quick if you have to bug out really fast. Now, the other two things I just really quickly want to mention, Artemis 3, obviously the long pole in the tent there is the human landing system. They want to go ahead, and do that, propellant transfer test on orbit. They said that is absolute bracelet. That's absolutely critical. There's a lot of collaboration between NASA and SpaceX going on there. For Artemis 4, there are some really good progress there going on with the Blue Origin lander. And Bray was basically saying they should sail right through, preliminary design review.
Cool. Hey, well, a bunch of good news there, I guess. The issues getting resolved,
yes,
and progress
sir.
Being made. Unfortunately, the war in Ukraine has had some, I don't know if you'd call them unanticipated effects, but they've had some effects on Roscosmos.
Yeah, they sure have. According to a report I saw on Newsweek, Roscosmos has decided to sell about $124 million in assets. And this is all due because of the sanctions placed upon it because of Russia's adventure in Ukraine. The 150 items that they want to sell off are basically what they call nice to have items, but these include various properties, sporting houses, complexes, land, recreational areas. The decision was made, according to Newsweek, after Roscosmos lost, and you're ready for this, about 80% of its export income after losing key orders and partnerships due to the war.
Wow.
So, with all due respect, I mean, they made their bed. They're going to have to sleep in it on.
So the sanctions are having some effect.
Indeed.
Wow. Well, let's hope that this all can get resolved soon. And the best way to do that is by getting the war resolved. That's a bigger ask.
Yeah. And that also leads me to wonder what does a post-war Roscosmos look like? You know, is anybody going to go back and play with them? I don't know. You know, it leads a lot of questions. What does a Roscosmos look like post ISS? You know, I mean, again, this leads a lot of questions for the future. And it's going to be what really, really makes me sad. And it really does. This was the preeminent space program at one point in its history. And first satellite in low Earth orbit, first human in space, first to launch two crew members in space, first to launch a woman into space. you know, they just racked up all of these firsts in initially and really humbled the heck out of us, until we kind of got our act together and got into our full up mode and got to the moon. What the devil does a post-war or a post-ISS Roscosmos look like? Yeah. I don't know. And it's going to be interesting to see what that does look like. Sad, actually.
Yeah. Agreed. Next thing we wanted to talk about was the death of former astronaut and NASA Administrator Richard Truly. Gene, you have some more details about that?
Yeah, unfortunately, Larry, I learned about this on the evening of February 27th. I saw something from the Association of Space Explorers on X that former NASA Administrator Richard Truly had passed away at the age of 86. He was, according to Space Policy Online, which I am reading here, he's probably going to be best remembered for his leadership at NASA in returning the space shuttle to flight after the Challenger accident. And he led the agency during a very tumultuous time. He was appointed by President George H.W. Bush, but he also was serving the nation as a vice admiral and had earned the Distinguished Flying Cross and was the first commander of the Naval Space Command. His career basically began in 1965 when he was selected for the Manned Orbiting Laboratory, the MOL program, which was a Defense Department initiative. It was basically putting a Defense Department space station in orbit to, well, to basically be an eye in the sky. Later on, he moved, when that program was canceled, he moved to NASA, and he served as CAPCOM for all three astronaut flights to the Skylab space station and for the Apollo-Soyuz test flight. And later on, he was on board the approach and landing tests on the Space Shuttle Enterprise. And he made the second flight on board the Space Shuttle. Young and Crippen threw the keys over to the STS-2 crew. After that point, he decided to retire and return to the Navy. He returned to NASA about 3 weeks after the Challenger tragedy, to lead the return to flight effort as associate administrator for spaceflight. He was then appointed after the shuttle returned to flight, NASA administrator under George H.W. Bush. And there was a little bit of a controversy there. He was butting heads a little bit with the administration on the SEI, the Space Exploration Initiative, which had a price tag of about something along the lines of about $300 to $400 billion. Whoa. Dollars. Congress was getting sticker shock in that. And unfortunately, of course, he was on the other end of that, where he was trying to push for SEI. He was also trying to push for the space station. At that point, it was called Space Station Freedom, and was trying to really, really push to get the, you know, to keep the shuttle program intact and keep it moving. And unfortunately, there was a bit of a power struggle. The White House had just reestablished the National Space Council under George H.W. Bush, and Dan Quayle was put in the driver's seat on that, then vice president. And I think between Quayle and Truly and everybody else, I think they were just butting heads, and a lot of the agency too was just getting a lot of bad press over the Hubble Space Telescope issue 90 after the launch. If you recall, the spherical aberration issue that Hubble suffered was later cured with a corrective lens. But unfortunately, all of this was happening on Trulli's watch. And unfortunately, according to Marcia Smith's article here in the end, quote, Trulli lost Bush's confidence. And most of the accounts refer to Trulli being fired. George H.W. Bush's statement, and I'm reading directly from Marcia Smith's article here, was a lot kinder. Quote, I today regretfully accepted the resignation of Richard Trulli as administrator of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. As a result of his leadership, NASA is better prepared for the 1990s and beyond. He has established a balanced space program, and he has worked closely with the vice president in developing our space exploration initiative that begins with Space Station Freedom. Close quote. Trulli, later on, praised Bush's support of the space program and NASA after 41 passed away in 2018. But he leaves behind a great legacy. And a statement from Bill Nelson, who flew on the space shuttle immediately before Challenger when he was a member of the House of Representatives, praised Trulli's service and to NASA and to the nation. And I'll just quote the piece here one more time. NASA is the place today because of people of character, vision, and the spirit of service. People like the great man we lost on February 27th, former NASA administrator, associate administrator, and astronaut Richard Trulli. His dedication of service to the Navy, to NASA, to his country. Richard lifted even higher humanity's quest to know the unknown and to achieve the impossible dream. Not a bad legacy to leave behind.
Mark, you had something you wanted to add.
Yeah, I just saw a post by none other than our very own Sawyer, and it has a photo of him, and he says he had the honor of meeting Dick Trulli and Bob Crippen back in 2012 when the original Enterprise exhibit opened on the Intrepid.
Very cool. So on to our next story, which is about some might consider it kind of boring, but I don't. It's lawmakers are deciding whether to extend expiring FAA commercial human spaceflight learning period. And the learning period has kind of a checkered history in that it keeps getting extended. And there are some people who say that's just fine because it gives current commercial spaceflight companies some leeway to do things the way they want to do them without too much regulation from the FAA. And people on the other side of the issue say, hey, we need some regulation. So anyway, Congress is currently deciding whether to extend current restrictions on the regulation of commercial human spaceflight occupants' safety. Representatives are expected to reach a decision very soon, like within the next week or so. The Commercial Space Act of 2023, passed by the House Science Committee last November, suggests extending the so-called learning period through September 2031. This period limits the FAA's Office of Commercial Space Transportation from regulating the safety of people who fly on commercial spacecraft. Duncan Rankin, senior advisor to Senator Ted Cruz, says, quote, the commercial sector has every incentive to make safe vehicles that bring people back safely to Earth. I have very little reason to believe that bureaucrats in a cubicle have a greater incentive to provide vehicle safety. However, Adam Weiss, counsel for the House Transportation Committee's Aviation Subcommittee, disagrees. He argues that while the commercial sector has incentives to ensure safety, accidents still occur. Weiss believes that preventing the FAA from making regulations, quote, does everyone a disservice, unquote. And in related news, The FAA's Office of Commercial Space Transportation has been preparing for the potential expiration of these regulations with the creation of an Aerospace Rulemaking Committee, or a SPARC, last June. The purpose of this committee is to gather industry input on future commercial human spaceflight safety regulations. However, Mary Lynn Dittmar, an Axiom Space executive who serves as co-chair of that SPARC, has stressed that the committee's work should not be tied to the expiration of the learning period. She believes that the focus should be on addressing the issues involved in rulemaking rather than rushing to complete the work before the learning period potentially ends in March. The SPARC is set to complete its work by June, but there is an option to extend the committee's work for an additional year. FAA Administrator Michael Whitaker has also urged the industry to take more steps to ensure the safety of people who fly on commercial spacecraft beyond government regulations. He stated, "As we increase the number of passengers traveling to space, the level of safety needs to meet that mission." Guys, got anything to add to that?
This has been going, there's been a back and forth. Industry basically says, you know, we need more time. The FAA is kind of pushing back and, you know, the federal government's kind of pushing back. How much, you know, it's a mess, plain English. And, I'm still trying to figure out what side I'm on at this point. I understand the need for regulation. And I think the folks on the other end also understand, but I think too, they're still trying to figure out what that should be yet. I'm leaning on the side of, Dr. Dittmar.
Yeah. Well, I think that, what I've always felt is that one of the most controversial pieces of that legislation is that the FAA is not allowed to do any safety rulemaking until someone dies, basically. If there's an accident where someone dies or someone outside, you know, a third party's property is damaged or something like that, something serious has to happen before the FAA can start rulemaking. And that just seems kind of like a backwards way to do things.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like the homicide detective coming over and saying, "Well, I can't do anything until somebody dies,"
right.
And
that's, right. You know, I mean,
it's kind of the same thing, it's the FAA wants to be proactive in things, and I can understand both sides of the coin. Again, I'm kind of leaning toward Dr. Dittmar in this case.
Yep,
and. And I mean, like for instance, too, back on February 26th, the FAA basically closed the SpaceX-led mishap investigation board into the second Starship mishap, and I believe there were about 17 corrective actions.
And by the way, were those 17 corrective actions ever publicized? Ever made public?
I have some bits and pieces from other entities, but I don't have the full picture.
And it wasn't like last time where SpaceX basically published at least most of the information. Some of it seemed like it was kind of scrubbed, but they communicated the basics of the, I think it was 63 items from the first integrated test flight.
Yeah. I mean, Tim Fernholz on X posted two things, and one of them I found kind of interesting. One was a brief paragraph about the ascent itself. He posted the following bit, and I guess this is from the FAA report. Quote, "Following a successful startup of all engines and separation from B9, which was the Starship designation, Starship 25 had a nominal ascent until 1309.55 UTC when the planned pre-second engine cutoff liquid oxygen dump started. Now, over the next minute, several explosions and sustained fires were observed in onboard cameras after the video stream, ultimately resulting in the loss of communication between the forward and aft flight computers. This resulted in a commanded shutdown of all six engines and an autonomous flight safety system flight termination triggering at 13:10:55 UTC per flight safety rules. I thought that was.
Yeah. But that's that narrative is not the same as publishing whatever the corrective actions were to keep that from happening again.
That's correct. And the only thing I have with the corrective actions are the following. One, and this is a paragraph that, again, Mr. Fernholz said, posted on X, quote, "The final B-9 and S-25 mishap investigation reports cited 17 corrective actions for SpaceX to implement. Seven booster corrective actions were identified, including redesigns of the vehicle hardware to increase tank filtration and reduce slosh, updated thrust and vector control system modeling, reevaluation of test analyses based on OFT2 data, and updated engine and control algorithms. Now, 10 Starship corrective actions were also identified, including hardware redesigns to increase robustness and reduce complexity." How vague can we be? Yeah. "Hardware changes to reduce leaks, operational changes eliminating pre-second engine cutoff propellant dumps, flammability analyses updates, installation of additional fire protection, creation of analytical guidance, performance of transient load analysis, and modeling updates."
It's a little bit more specific, but not a whole lot. I especially like the part about let's not do that again. Let's not dump the locks before the engine shut off again.
That's probably a good idea, but I kind of wish we did get into specifics. Now, I know there are proprietary stuff going on and all that, and I understand that, but I really wish we had a little bit more data to go on as far as what occurred on this whole thing. So, I mean, after all, this is involved, like it or not, this is part of the arms
program. And I think we need to also say that, we're giving them a little bit of crap here, but in the end, we're cheering for SpaceX as much as the next guy.
I mean, here's the deal. You know, if this succeeds, then Ornimus succeeds, and that's where I want it to succeed, and I'd like it to succeed within the timetable that we think we're going to get Artemis 3 going. And they are right now in the long pole in the tent right now. And they really, really have to get their act together a little bit and kind of solve some of these problems before we go on. I just want to see this thing succeed. I want to see it go. I want to see it do its thing. I want to see prop transfer. I want to see all of that, because if they can work all of that out, that means we're getting to the moon.
Yep. Totally agreed. So for our last bit of news roundup news, this comes about that NASA has canceled the OSAM-1 satellite servicing technology mission. I'm looking at an article here by Jeff Faust from Space News, and he says that NASA has canceled a multi-billion-dollar project to demonstrate satellite servicing technologies that had suffered extensive delays and cost overruns. In a brief statement on March 1st, NASA announced it was ending the on-orbit servicing, assembly, and manufacturing one mission. OSAM-1 was being developed to refuel the Landsat 7 spacecraft and then perform the in-orbit assembly of a Ka-band satellite antenna. Wow, that sounds really complicated. NASA said it was canceling OSAM-1, quote, "due to the continued technical, cost, and schedule challenges and a broader community evolution away from refueling unprepared spacecraft, which has led to a lack of a committed partner." So basically, they're saying that advancements in technology have gotten away from them, and nobody's really interested in all these old spacecraft that might need refueling that aren't really set up to do it and make things more complicated than they're supposed to be. That's my read on it anyway. So they don't really have, lack of a committed partner to me means not much business potential there. So
this has been going on for a while. This program, it started out life as under another label, Restore-L. I believe
they want, it says, it has down here, they wanted the goal of to... they wanted a goal of launching to refuel Landsat 7 back in 2020.
Right. So this program's been going on for a while, but I'll also add too that Northrop Grumman's already demonstrated this technology. So I think that had a lot to do with this going bye-bye. Northrop Grumman had already done a refueling mission a couple of years back. So my thought is they've already proved that they have the technology. Why go ahead, considering the cost overruns, considering all of the pounding on the head that we couldn't get this system to work? Somebody else has already got it working. And I think it was a no-brainer to go ahead and just say, throw in the towel and say,
yeah, especially when you factor in the cost overruns and delays. Like, see, April 2022, the mission's total cost was once projected to be between $626 million and $753 million. But by then, it had grown to $2.05 billion, and its launch delayed to September 2026. So,
yeah, I mean, why go ahead and reinvent the wheel when somebody else has already proven the concept?
I guess that's what it comes down to.
Yeah, exactly. And now here they are, you know, here's SpaceX trying to do the same thing in conjunction with Artemis. And, you know, we're talking about fueling something on orbit. And this is something that's kind of key to what they're trying to do. So I'm sure NASA is going to take some of those lessons learned and say, okay, here's what not to do, and, you know, apply those lessons for SpaceX. So a lot of, maybe perhaps some of the homework has been done with some of this on orbit refueling stuff. And again, as I'll mention, Northrop Grumman's already done it.
Yep. So, and
I'll interrupt and mention some history. In 2011, one of the last payloads going up to station on a space shuttle was the robotic refueling mission.
Right.
And think of that as a busy box with different type of fueling points. And, you know, it was to demonstrate that the robotic arms on station could manipulate the hardware that would be found on spacecraft that were not designed to be refueled, that could be manipulated. So this goes back to then, and interesting bit of history for you.
Mark, I'm glad you remembered that, because I recall, and I think you were with me, we attended the press conference for that during that shuttle mission. And I remember talking to the gentleman that was in charge of that program. We had a very long conversation about what the pratfalls were and so on and so forth around orbital refueling. So I have to now, shoot, Mark, I'm going to have to go back and find those notes. I know I have them from somewhere, because I still have, you know, believe I'm a pack rat. I still have the darn notebook from the time I was over at KSC and writing all this stuff down with you. And I, gosh darn it, I think I actually even have some photographs from that busy box, if you will.
Yeah, it was quite interesting. And that was a cargo that flew on Atlantis, STS-135. I'd forgotten that detail, but
I mean, shoot, I mean, I remember how big that thing was too. They had a mock-up of that in the press room, and it was sizable. I mean, The thing was, I'm about 5'8", and it was almost as tall as I was. So it was quite a you know, and a busy box is a very apt term for that. It had a lot of, you know, an assortment of hookups and all of that. And they wanted to test to see if they could go ahead and latch on to each one of these things and make a good airtight seal in each one of them.
Yeah, I read a little bit more about it, which I won't go into, but there were three phases of that program, which, again, dates back to launch in 2011. So,
wow.
It's coming. It'll get here.
Yes.
But in the meantime, rest in peace, OSAM-1 project. So our big story tonight, I think, is the IM-1 lunar lander. And I wanted to just remind you of the clip that we played at the beginning of the show from Apollo 17 back in 1972. And that was the last time that an American lunar lander was on the moon 52 years ago, until the IM-1 did it. And the mission, you know, to talk about a summary of the mission, it was not an easy mission for the Intuitive Machines team. There were a number, I think they said that there was like 11 big issues, right, Gene, that cropped up, and some of them were more easily fixable than others, and they didn't go into details about them, but there were several that they did go into detail about. And one of them started, now refresh my memory about this, Gene. One of them started barely an hour or two into the mission when they realized their star tracker wasn't working.
Yeah, that was one of the myriad of problems. There were a whole bunch of other things, including the laser system that happened during landing. They were juggling about maybe, it seemed like they were putting out fires, a lot of them as they went along. And I mean, it's a testament to the entire team that the program actually, that the whole mission actually worked as well as it did, but also, too, that I think they realized that they were pushing themselves a little bit too hard. They had three teams, you know, the red team, the white team, and the blue team, similar to what they do over at Mission Control.
And then they also had the top guys, which was like a fourth team that would.
Yeah, that was the name for it, Team Four. They basically had, you know, it was basically a safety valve for the other three teams to say, hey, you know, we're working this thing, but we need somebody in depth to go ahead. They were essentially the backroom guys, if you will, you know, if you remember from Apollo, that would go ahead and really, really try to work a problem and say, you know, and afterwards say, hey, I think we got a solution for you here. Try it. And then, of course, then there was the executive level with Tim Crane and Steve Altemus. And I think if I recall exactly during the press conference, they basically said the entire teams, all three of them, basically gelled into one.
Yeah, it was basically sleep when you can, and the rest of the time everybody's here. The three shift idea went out the window.
And that kind of is, they basically said that was probably kind of indicative of a problem with personnel. They just didn't have enough Indians to go ahead and work the problem. They didn't have enough of the worker bees to go ahead and work the issue. And I think too, that's going to be something that they're going to look at for the next mission, to kind of bolster that team up a little bit more. So then this way they can still have teams dedicated to, you know, operations, but then also have, you know, tiger teams for each, you know, my deal would be like a tiger team for each one of those shifts, if you will, where you have a back room, set away to work on each problem. And maybe that's what they may implement. I'm not Tim Crane, or I'm not Steve Altima, so I don't really know how they're going to play it, but that might be the way they do it going forward.
And not all the problems either were caused by stuff that was beyond their control and just happened in flight. You know, one of the most dramatic things was a pre-landing, a couple of hours before landing, scramble to write and upload a software patch when Intuitive Machines realized that the lander's primary laser rangefinder nav instrument was inoperative because of an error during final ground prep of the lander. They had a wiring harness that was supposed to, that was not plugged in because it that was their safety interlock for a level 4 laser that, they needed to make sure people didn't injure themselves by the laser going off accidentally. So they left it unplugged and forgot to plug it in again before they buttoned it up for launch. Basically, left that system on safety so that it could only be disabled by plugging it in. They couldn't fix it remotely by a software patch. So the loss of that navigation system would have resulted in mission failure. But then they realized that they could substitute that system with one of the NASA experimental payloads that happened to be a different type of navigational system, navigation Doppler LIDAR, that could be plumbed in via a software patch as a substitute primary nav aid. So Tim Crane had an interesting quote. He said, "In normal software development for a spacecraft, this is the kind of thing that would have taken a month. But," he said, "our team basically did that in an hour and a half."
Yeah. And too, the idea that came up with it was on the fly. I believe it was Tim Crane himself that came up with the idea of trying to cross-reference the two systems, and he was the one to reach out to NASA and say, "Hey, is this actually possible? Could we do it?" And NASA said, "Well, gee, let me think about that." Yeah, of course. And they decided that they were going to go ahead and test this thing on the fly rather than going ahead and rather than going ahead and going through what a normal test program. And through that, NASA learned a ton, and so did Intuitive. And NASA learned a lot about the instrument that they had, and Intuitive Machines got the ride.
They were forced to test that system on a live spacecraft in a live landing. So they went from being, I forget what the technical term is, but a level 5 or a level 6 in the design concept,
yeah,
through being field tested and proven and everything. They went from a level 6 all the way to a level 9 out of 10.
I mean it was a real, I'm sure the folks over at Langley who were responsible for the navigation Doppler LIDAR system were pleased with the fact that hey, we just got thrown into the driver's seat.
That solution only worked up to a point. The flight computer on the lander, as it turns out, couldn't process the data from the NASA payload in real time. So therefore, the lander had no accurate up-to-date altitude information for the last 12 minutes before the landing. It was just depending upon its optical camera landing system. And that optical camera was not accurate enough. As a result, the lander thought it was about 100 meters higher above the moon's surface than it actually was when it landed. So that unexpectedly hard 6 meters per second downward landing speed, and I think it was 2 meters per second sideways landing speed, caused one of the lander's six legs to snap. And there's a photo that they published of this moment with the lander and its snapped legs still upright that they Intuitive Machines released during a press conference last Wednesday. And we'll put that up on our episode page on our website at talkingspaceonline.com.
Yeah, I'm looking right at it. It basically has the leg kind of, there's it's so flimsy. It's ridiculous. And Chris Lewicki over on X posted So does Breakaway now carry the same positive intent as it does in theater? And as a thespian myself, I have to say, yeah, I'll take it. Sure. Why not? It was a miracle they actually pulled this off.
Were you listening after they landed when they were waiting for a signal after landing and 2 minutes went by?
Oh, Tim Crane went by. Yeah, Tim Crane's famous line, "We're not dead yet." I was there biting my nails with him until, you know, it looked like for sure that we had at least a vague data packet coming from the spacecraft. So I was right there with him biting my my nails too, down to the nub on this. But what I saw out there on social media and even through some of the news outlets and some of the other individuals that I'll just characterize as armchair astronauts, and they were saying that the mission was kind of a failure, and
just because what, it didn't land upright, it landed at a 30-degree angle, as it turned out.
Precisely. My thought on the whole thing was, okay, fine. You know, did things go the way they wanted to? No, they didn't. Did they check all the boxes on this flight? No, they didn't. Did they learn a little bit? Oh yeah, they learned a ton. They also learned how to work as a team and, you know, work things on the fly. So it's going to solidify the team on the ground when they go for the next follow-up mission. That's one. Two, did they get data from the spacecraft? Yes. Did they get usable data from the spacecraft? Yes. Are the clients that paid for the payloads, aka the U.S. taxpayer in some instances, did they get data from these instruments that we had on there? Yes, they did. Did we get usable data? Yeah, we did. Did we get more than what we bargained for in some instances? Yeah, we did. So, you know, to me, that's a win.
Yeah.
I don't know about you. Yes, the thing landed not in the way we wanted it to. It is at a 30-degree angle on the lunar south pole, mm-hmm. folks. I'm just going to underline that in red three times when I say it. So a place that the United States has never touched down before. So, and this is a private company. There was a lot of other criticisms too. I know that one criticism from one of the YouTubers out there was saying, oh, they didn't have real-time telemetry on their webcast. It was kind of, you know, really done amateurish and all this. My thought is, do you know what the quote studio was? Because I remember seeing this on a IM post on X. Intuitive Machines posted they converted an old closet in the building into their communications center.
This is not a super well-funded concern, right? It's a shoestring company.
Yeah, I mean, guys, this isn't NASA, okay? You know, this is a company that is doing this on a shoestring. They had to start up an entire lunar program in 4 years and fly to the lunar South Pole, something that NASA has not done before. Okay. And they had to do it in the time that it would take, you know, you and me to do a bachelor's degree. So, we're not talking a ton of money here. Was the comms in good shape? I think they had some other fish to fry as far as, you know, the PR and public relations. Did they fall short a little bit? Yeah, they did. But again, I think the emphasis was more on the operations and on the vehicle itself rather than on the PR stuff to it. That's why folks like us are here, to try to go ahead and tell the story of what occurred. And I think a lot of the criticism in some areas, yeah, okay, fine. You know, as far as the landing was concerned, I will do what Michael Sheets did and invoke the words of Chuck Yeager. Any landing you can walk away from is a good one. Any landing that you can go ahead and use the plane tomorrow, that's outstanding. So I think this kind of falls into that kind of category. I think a lot of the hemming and hawing and gnashing of teeth that I saw on social media about the mission and about the way things were conducted, I think it was, you know, some was founded, but some I thought, you know, come on, man, cut them a break. I mean, we're not dealing with a unlimited budget here. We are dealing with a company that's operating on the shoestring. We're dealing with a startup company that, you know, didn't have a lot of the resources that, you know, the government has when they go ahead and do a space mission. They don't have the outreach dollars that NASA has. You know, cut them a break. And they learned a ton from this mission. The other thing too that everybody was yelling, screaming about was the Embry-Riddle Eagle cam. And people were saying, oh, when are we going to see pictures from that? When are they going to deploy the thing? Come on, come on, come on, come on. And I'm like, I think they probably want to go ahead and make sure the spacecraft, because they know they're on a tilt, they want to make sure the spacecraft is still in good shape. And I think that experiment was kind of like, well, we'll get to it, guys, because they're a paying customer, but let's make sure that we've got a good platform before we deploy that particular thing. Make sure that our platform can support what they're doing. And as things turned out, unfortunately, they did deploy Eagle Cam, and unfortunately, because of a Wi-Fi glitch, I believe the camera didn't operate correctly. And I believe Steve Altemus said, you know, it kind of broke his heart. He'd love to fly that payload again, but again, that's up to the school and up to what they want to do, and so on.
He also did mention that they've got the message loud and clear from everybody that the most important thing they're going to work on for IM2 in terms of design changes is more antennas and more cameras. We heard you loud and clear on that one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, and well, definitely we want more antennas, because that would have really, really helped in this instance, because they landed in such a, you know, the attitude of the spacecraft was such that they really could have used those secondary antennas, because I don't think they had enough coverage as it was at that point because of the attitude of the vehicle. One of the things though that they did learn, again, I believe it was either Tim Crane or Steve Altemus did say, yeah, they did have to be a little better with their communications. And, that was something too that they're going to look into for the next time. But they pulled off a lot of good stuff with PR too. And again, I'm not going to go ahead and, because a lot of people were playing, you know, if I'm going to date myself here with that old Bugs Bunny routine, don't pile on the rabbit. You know, a lot of people were literally doing that. And I just said, you know, come on, guys. To me, a lot of the criticism, I don't think was valid. In some instances here, yeah, they didn't check all the boxes. There's a lot to do before they go ahead and try this again. I'm sure there's going to be a little bit of soul searching going on within Intuitive Machines to see, okay, how could we do this better next time? You know, what things do we have to do? I mean, even Steve Altemus said, if that was the only thing we did wrong, that you alluded to, Larry, is that pin that was sort of left in there. If that was the only thing that we did, you know, that we overlooked, he'll take it. He'll live with it.
Yep.
And, you know, I think that kind of summed up really the entire mission.
You can bet all those things that he mentioned that went wrong, they're going to do their best to make sure those never happen again.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, again, this and to go ahead and look at this from a NASA aspect, NASA knows that not all of these missions are going to make it. That's why way back when this mission, when this whole CLPS thing was brought to bear by Jim Bridenstine and Thomas Zurbuchen, they both kind of characterized this thing as shots on goal. They know that they're taking risks, and they would rather go ahead and take the risks now. The mission cost $118 million, yep. If I'm not mistaken. Now, to my audience, they all just went,
and that includes, you know, that includes that's a ton of, like $52 million or something just to get it to the moon, you know, just what they had to pay SpaceX.
Yeah. I mean, that includes the booster. Yeah, that includes paying for the ride in Falcon 9. So from a space aspect, this is chump change. You know, and so this is why NASA's trying this. They're trying to do this not only to see, number one, you know, industry has been telling them for years that, oh, we can do this. Well, now it's time to put your money where your mouth is. So they're going to try to go ahead and do all this stuff. But the idea too is to not only get science ahead of, you know, ahead of the Artemis missions, but also eventually perhaps getting cargo ahead of the Artemis missions and having some more experimentation, more experiment packages, more tools and so on sent to the lunar surface ahead of an Artemis mission. And left there on the moon for the astronauts to go ahead and pick up and utilize. And perhaps too later on, as a presence on the lunar South Pole gets established, to go ahead and have, you know, other logistics sent to the moon the same way we do with ISS.
And further out into the future is doing all the same things, but on Mars instead of the moon. So.
Exactly. And that's where, you know, that's where CLPS is going with this. So, and also it's opening up a lunar economy. We had, again, when Chantel Bear was here, we talked about other commercial aspects of the mission. And, I believe, Columbia with the, thermal cloth that they had on Intuitive Machines, it worked very well. It actually exceeded expectations. And if I'm not mistaken, they basically said, hey, this is probably going to form a partnership between Columbia and Intuitive Machines, where they're going to go ahead and use that thermal blanket where it's required on future missions. So this also spurned off a partnership as well between the two companies. And this is what NASA wanted. As when they set this whole thing up and set this thing up into motion. So congrats. And so I'm going to go ahead and applaud, you know, Tim Crane. I'm going to applaud Steve Altemus. I'm going to applaud, everybody involved in this mission. And I'm also going to applaud tonight, Jim Bridenstine and Thomas Zurbuchen, because they were also the ones that were really, really pushing CLPS. And gosh darn it, the United States is back on the moon. And if I'm, you know, another accusatory thing that I heard too was, you know, we're being jingoistic by waving the flag and saying, hey, we're back on the moon. I don't think so. I think this is a moment of, it was a moment of pride a little bit. Not only pride for the companies involved, but also pride in the country that basically set this thing up so that this way these two folks can succeed.
So before we leave this subject, I wanted to you mentioned Chantel Bayer earlier, wanted to discuss a little bit about the Jeff Koons Moon Phases project. Turns out, sadly, the E-panel of the lander, which is the one where the Moon Phases art cube is mounted, is the side of the lander that's facing down toward the lunar surface, since the lander tipped over a bit. And that's disappointing to see, but, you know, hey, it's still there and it's in one piece. So,
And that's basically all I think Chantel really wanted. And to be honest with you, I think again, somebody like her, this is, opens up more opportunities for her company as well to go ahead and try to move companies that may want to go ahead and run an experiment or run something to the lunar surface, and she'll help expedite that and get through all of the red tape and all of the certifications and what materials you need to use and blah and all that. So, and that's what her company's there for. Hey, Mark, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, I'm sort of backing you up though. I had a realization 13, 14 years ago that I needed to adjust my definition of success, because in, let's go back to August of 2012, SpaceX launched their fourth Falcon 9, and I was upset somewhat. I mean, I was critical, let's just say, at a press conference when they mentioned that they had lost an engine during launch, and that they made it to orbit successfully on 8 engines. And I was kind of put in my place that, yes, and we made it to orbit on 8 engines. Yes, we did lose an engine. So the fourth flight of the Falcon 9, the first of CRS, actually this was CRS-1, which I'll mention later, was a success, even though if you were going to be harshly critical, which I wasn't necessarily thinking that way, but we have to readjust our definition of success. SpaceX has certainly gone with having us adjust ours over the years, and IM-1 was a success.
No question. No question.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you.
No question. So, Mark, I wanted to ask you, what are the current possibilities of getting Chantel back on the show to give her impressions of the whole mission and how things turned out?
We definitely will get together. We'll be talking to her on a future episode. She has a lot going on, and I'm looking forward to hearing more about it. So, yes.
Indeed. I'm looking forward to hearing more about what Four Space is up to. Thanks.
Very good. And so for our last story tonight, Mark has interviewed an award-winning artist and an in-person launching viewing newbie that we encountered at the IM-1 launch. Mark, you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Certainly. And I mentioned just a moment ago that I was going to refer back to this, and I will. But CRS-1 that launched in 2012 was a launch that I attended along with the NASA social operation. And I interviewed 7-8 people that were there for the NASA social. And I believe they were probably all seeing their first launch and asking them what their impressions are. So the interview that you're going to hear in just a minute was somebody seeing their first launch. And I couldn't not get in touch with this woman to ask her what her reactions were, thinking back to 13, 14 years ago when I talked to a number of people for that CRS-1. So here is the interview. I hope you can appreciate it, and maybe it will spur a little future attendance for people that haven't seen one. Here we go.
So as our Talking Space listeners are aware, recently, I was at a SpaceX launch, and we've talked a lot about it, and we can talk a lot more, which is why I invited one of the guests at the launch to join me and talk a little bit about her experience. You know, one of the things that never ceases to amaze me is how wide the appeal is for space, space technology, crew in space, and rocket launches. Joining me now is an artist, award-winning, New York Times best-selling series, DC Superhero Girls, also Teen Titans Go, My Little Pony, and Care Bears. Welcome to Talking Space, Agnes Garboska.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me, here we met in the Rocket Garden. It was on the 13th of February, I believe, still at that time. And what news had we just found out?
Oh, yes. The rocket launch was canceled that night.
Ah, how did you feel with that thought? Because you traveled to get there, right?
Yeah, I traveled all the way from Los Angeles, actually, to get there. And I was coming into town just for the launch. The funny thing, though, was I wasn't as upset as I thought I would be, because a lot of people who have seen launches, they kept telling me, like, just know it can be canceled. Just know it can be canceled. So when it got canceled, I was almost expecting it. So I told my friend, I don't know why I was so confident. I told her, I'm like, I'll go off tomorrow. I know I'll go off tomorrow. And plus, like, leading up to the moment, I was already enjoying the trip very much and just meeting the people. I was doing little activities. I saw manatees earlier in that day, and it was just the experience of, it was the first trip I did with that friend. So I was like, even if the launch is canceled, as much as it sucks, I was still having a good experience on the trip. I don't know why, but I was so confident it was just going to go off the next day.
Well, that's an excellent attitude, because it doesn't always work that way. We had our good day the next day when SpaceX launched. I got to ask, was this your first rocket launch? Because I remember as we were heading to the bleachers at Banana Creek, you asked me if I had seen many launches.
Yeah, it was my first one. I was very excited learning that it wasn't yours.
And tell me, what was it like? How did you feel, you know, just the... 30 minutes, 45 minutes, however long we were there waiting, and then the actual launch itself. Go ahead and walk me through it.
Yeah, well, I felt very cold. I'm glad that I bought it earlier during that. I was telling my friend, I'm like, it's almost like the universe knew everyone came underdressed the night before, because everyone, like, looked like they're dressed much warmer. So I was just telling, I'm like, I think the universe knew everyone was underdressed from the party and wanted us to dress warmer tonight, because I bundled myself up and I was so happy I did, but that cold was so worth the experience, because it was magical, especially seeing it for the first time. And the first thing, the advice I got was, make sure not to be looking at your phone, make sure to be looking at the rocket. So that's exactly what I did. I kind of used my bag as a tripod, just left a recording, so I didn't look at my phone at all during the launch till it was done to see if it actually recorded something or not. But it was spectacular. It was one of those experiences. Just the feeling of it and just feeling the energy and then the vibration of the bleachers and actually being there in the moment with so many other people just as excited as I, it was something that I think everyone should experience, because it was just magical. Like everything from seeing the sheer power of the rocket taking off to just the whole night. I hope that won't be my last launch.
Well, good. That's the part I like to hear, because I've seen a few, and the thing that surprised me, my wife and I saw STS-1 back in 1981, I'm sorry.
Oh, wow.
And we went,
that's a long time ago.
We went from STS-1 to STS-129, not seeing any shuttle launches in person. And that's the thing that is tough. Time just gets away, and all of a sudden, it's been longer than you think. But I can tell you that everyone that you can get to, and if it's different rockets that you see, every launch is different. Some you hear more, some you feel more. The fact that you were at a night launch, you couldn't have picked a better one to come to, because you got the experience of the day before with the scrub. Okay, we're not launching today. Come back tomorrow, hopefully, is what was in my mind. What did you think about the booster landing?
It was just really, like, and I remember people telling me beforehand, like, where to look. And it was really cool. Like, both the rocket launch and the booster landing, it was almost like the sun went up at night for split moments. And that boom, like, afterwards when I was landing was insane. It was so loud. It was really, really cool, because it felt like you look up and you look down and you get to see. And it felt like a full experience to me. So I know a lot of people said I was really lucky to be able to see the booster land as well.
Do you have an opportunity? I know L.A. is probably not close to Vandenberg. That's up in the northern part of the state, isn't it? You think you'd be able to see any from that area?
Not where I live, definitely. But I did find out on that trip that there is I didn't even know that on this coast rockets do take off. I learned that on that trip, and that there's a chance to catch you when watching from a distance. I don't know the location compared to where I am, but it is something I'm going to be looking up to try to keep track of, because apparently you can watch them from a further distance here, which would be really cool. I know where I live in LA, that is not possible. I would have to drive out at least, I think, an hour, if not more, to wherever it is. But that, I have to do the research. It would be cool to see.
Well, where I live in relation to Kennedy Space Center is about 160 or so miles. And if the conditions are good, if it's nighttime, of course, if there's no clouds, you can see it. You can see a launch. You miss the first minute of it so, as far away as we are. And I know that other people on our team live in South Florida, and they've gotten some great photos, you know, even I would have to guess 100 miles or more away. So you don't necessarily have to be right on top of it, but when you're close, you get to feel that energy.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was so sensational, because you really like understand and feel the force, the majestic power of this rocket. Oh, it's so insane.
I love hearing you talk about it. I'm so thankful that we got to talk for a few minutes, and that I was able to. And that's another part of our little chat here. You gave me a sticker, and it was a pretty, you'll have to describe it, because I've already given it to a friend's daughter. And don't have it for reference, but a sticker that made me think, what is this, and who is this person? So tell me about that part of your life.
Yeah, I work on all-age content, mainly for kids, but kind of content that you can enjoy, parents can enjoy with their kids. I mainly work on comic books and illustration, but I like to create my own characters. And one of the characters I created is this little dinosaur called Rexy that likes to dress up in different outfits. So you've got his unicorn outfit. And just speaking about space, actually, one of my favorite books that I worked on actually involves space. And it was an issue of DC Superhero Girls called Spaced Out, where they all go into outer space to rescue their friends. So I'm like, funny that like I got to see a lunch, and my favorite issue that I ever worked on involves space as well. So clearly, I am a fan of everything space related.
Well, Agnes, I wish you the best of luck on your next launch, and I hope it's a great one. Do you think you'll be, are you focused on a kind of a side question? Have you been focused much on space flight and space technology prior to this?
I'm not super deep into it, but I do try to follow a little bit along. Usually my friend informs me whenever she gets excited about something that's coming up, and after this launch I'm definitely going to be paying a little more closer attention to things.
Thank you, Agnes, for joining us. Thank you for sharing. Best of luck on future launches. Oh, sorry, I gotta do this. Not too long ago, in fact, I think it was one of the SpaceX crew six landing, I saw it at night doing re-entry over Central Florida, landing off the northeast coast of Florida in the Atlantic. And it it presents a gorgeous plasma trail, colors that I think you would probably use in some of your art, but it was the most incredible thing to see it streaking across the sky. And the speed and the color, I don't know. I think they've been landing off Florida. I'm sure they seem like there was a landing off the coast of California, but that could have been the Orion capsule for the Artemis 1 launch. But that's something else to look for.
Oh, that's cool. Thank you for letting me know that too.
So thank you, Agnes, for joining us on Talking Space. Have a good day.
Thank you for having me.
Mark, I love when you go ahead and you find somebody that has not seen a launch before. You can hear the enthusiasm in their voice. You can hear the emotion coming through. And I'm hoping that when people listen to this, it encourages them to go see one of these things. I don't really much care what you go see, but it does change you. Either either go to KSC, go to Wallops if there's a Rocket Lab launch over there. Go to Vandenberg and in and around there if you can, and just witness one of these things. It is really a life changing kind of experience. Mark, I'm still remembering way back when in ancient history with STS-129 and our first launch with part of the crew at least, and just remembering the reaction of everybody gathered around. You were there, some other folks, Catherine Qualthor, I remember, and a few others. We were just, I mean, I have no words for the emotions that were going through our heads after that. And if somebody else could go ahead and share that experience, that's when every time I see one of those NASA social calls, I always kind of repost it out there and say, hey, you know, you really got to sign up for one of these. If you haven't already, give it a shot, especially if it's one of the launch, launch events, because number one, they'll roll out the red carpet for you. But number two is you're going to see something that is just jaw dropping, and you're going to have to go ahead, bring that memory back to your family, to your friends, to your community, and talk about it, because the magic of spaceflight is right there, right in front of your eyes. And just take it in, drink it in, behold it, hang on to it, and just take that memory back with you.
Very good. Thank you, Gene. And that does it for us here. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for joining us tonight. Gene?
Yeah, Larry, thanks a lot. And one of the things I want to say, because I don't say it enough, and I thought about this when I was just coming on, I don't say thank you to you, the listener, enough. And I just want to go ahead and just take this moment to say thanks for downloading this. Thanks for listening. Thanks for making us a part of your day. And this is why we do it, so we can bring the excitement and some of the analysis and some of the spirit of spaceflight to you. And I hope you took that away from all of this tonight. So again, thanks for listening. It was one of those drink from several fire hoses episodes. We ran long. I apologize, but shoot, I think it was well worth it. And I'm hoping you enjoy the episode. Thanks a lot.
And good evening, Mark. Thanks for being here.
Good to be here as always. And for our listeners, get in touch with us. We're on social media here, there, and everywhere. But also, don't forget mailbag@talkingspaceonline.com. We got our website and email issues straightened out. So get in touch with us. Let us know what you think, what you'd like to see. And we appreciate any communication that you'll send our way.
We're on Blue Sky, guys. I just created the Blue Sky account earlier this week, so we're up on Blue Sky, so look for us. I'm going to start posting there.
Address is Talking Space, I assume?
Yes, sir, it is.
Very
Talking
good.
Talking Space.
I also wanted to mention that we have a way on our website now. In the lower right-hand corner of every page of the website is a little microphone symbol, and if you click on that, you can, if you have a microphone on your laptop or some other microphone that you have connected, you can leave us a voicemail in which you can ask us a question, make a comment, tell us about something that you want to tell us about. And if it's appropriate, we'll play it on the show and talk about it on the show. So with that said, I'm Larry Herron, and I wish you a good day, and thanks for being with us, and we'll see you next time.